Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Biden. This is Open Source. An army chaplain summed up defeat in Afghanistan this way. The war was begun, he wrote, for no wise purpose, carried on with a strange mixture of rashness and timidity, brought to a close after suffering and disaster. Not one benefit, political or military, has been acquired with this war. The writer was an English reverend, noting what he had seen of the first Afghan war and the rout and deaths of 14,000 British invaders in 1842, the beginning of the end of the British Empire. Our guest, William Dalrymple, has the story for today. He's the Scotsman gone halfway native in India who wrote the dazzling, depressing history of that first modern battle for Afghanistan. And he autographed copies of his book at the White House in 2013 for President Obama, who was extending the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and for his successor, Joe Biden, who has just now ended our engagement. Where to begin, Willie Dalrymple, on the parallels here? And who says history doesn't repeat itself to the letter? Motives, mindsets, hubris, folly.
You're right, Chris, that history can advise us in a very general sense about the way things can go. But I would be hard-pressed to find any parallel closer than the two wars for Afghanistan, the British one in 1839 to 42 and the one we've just seen the end of this week. There are so many parallels between the two which are crying out to be pointed out and which, amazingly, the media has really not pointed out.
Tick off a few.
Both campaigns were inspired by trying to put a more acceptable ruler onto the throne of Afghanistan. In 1839, the force trying to play the puppeteer was not even the British Raj. It was a private company called the East India Company. And the East India Company was like everything that we most fear about Google or Facebook, an enormous multinational, hugely rich, hugely influential, able to bend our wills and change our politics. But the difference with the East India Company is it had one of the largest armies in the world. In 1839, it had 200,000 mercenary Indian troops, and it used this incredible power of modern weaponry to march into Afghanistan in 1839 with largely commercial ends in mind. The East India Company had just taken over India. It had done very well by flooding India with British merchandise and using the Indian river systems, particularly the Ganges, to extract raw materials and items it could sell in the West, such as opium and so on, using the Indian river system. What they hoped to do was to use the Indus to do the same in Central Asia. Hmm. So in 1839, an army of British soldiers and Indian mercenary sepoys march into Afghanistan, the Bengal Larsens with scarlet shakos and these gorgeous uniforms march into Afghanistan with barely a shot of resistance fired against them. They install in Afghanistan the old ruler, Shah Shuja, who they hope will be their puppet. Everything goes well for a year. They shoot duck, they race horses, they go fox hunting. And then, as winter draws in, things begin to turn against them. The tribes rise against them. There is a massive resistance. They are defeated in the plains around Kabul, and they then march out. 20,000 men, women, and children march out of the cantonment. One man makes it through to Jalalabad. Why is this an important story? It's an important story because the man that the British installed in Kabul in 1839 is the direct forebear of the man the Americans installed in 2001. Hamid Karzai is the great-great-great-great-grandson of Shah Shuja al-Mulk, who the British put in 1839 and who was killed in 1842. Likewise, the tribes which rose up against the British were a tribe called the Gilzai Confederation, and the head of the Gilzai today was Mullah Omar. So beneath what we see is a very simple story of liberal democracy fighting off medieval Islamist barbarism is in fact just an old tribal rivalry under new flags. The Popalzai, the landlords, the aristocrats, who the British installed in 1839 and the Americans reinstalled in 2001, opposed by the landless, the dispossessed, the day labourers and the share workers, the Gilzai tribe, who brought down the British in 1842 and last week brought down and humiliated the Americans in Kabul in 2021.
Speak of the mindsets then and now, parallel or not. The British hawks in the 1830s, private and public, were not in the closet. They loved the great game for Central Asia. The mission was to seize Afghanistan, hold the high road between Iran and China, between Samarkand to the north and Delhi to the south, and then the prize was yours. How much different today?
Well, in both cases, I think the sweetener of this pill was the fact that if you controlled Afghanistan, you controlled the top story of Asia. If you sat in Kabul, you were in a very good position to control not just Afghanistan, but the lands around it. India to the south, Iran to the west, what today is the Stans, Central Asia to the north, but then were the sultanates of Bukhara, Khiva, and Tashkent, and then to the east, China. And so imperial powers who have a view to establishing primacy or hegemony over Asia have always seen Afghanistan as an incredibly attractive prize, at least from afar. But what is true in both occasions is that once they actually get there, they find that the cost of occupying this territory in every sense is more than they can afford, both in terms of resources and in terms of lives lost in resisting the local tribesmen. Let me be clear about that. The East India Company was a very profitable commercial enterprise that was making a great deal of money by growing opium in India and selling it illegally in China in the largest narcotics operation in history. This makes the Medellin cartel look like sort of children's toys. These guys were making vast continental sums of money. And one of the things they did with the profits, just to put this into an American context, was that they bought tea in China with the profits, which they then shipped around the globe. And the tea that was dumped in Boston Harbor at the beginning of the American Revolution is East India Company tea bought in China with the profits of the opium trade. So in other words, if you invade and colonize India, commercially, it's a very profitable thing to do. But if you then go and extend yourself and conquer Afghanistan, it turns out to be a massive loss maker. And the East India Company spent a huge fortune moving troops up to Central Asia, moving food to feed them, building, you know, expensive fortifications and communications to keep this army up there. And they found that what had been an extremely profitable enterprise in India turned suddenly into the red. It's not that the imperial powers could not hold Afghanistan. They could have held it if they wanted to. And if they, you know, put an incredible amount of money into the project and just kept pouring men, resources and weapons in, they could potentially have won this. But in both cases, they just decided it simply wasn't worth it, that the costs outweighed the benefits. So in both cases, whether with the East India Company in 1842 or with the Americans today, in terms of the political cost, as well as the financial cost of occupying Afghanistan and the body bags coming back and the unpopularity of having what was beginning to be seen as a forever war, in both cases, they decided just to cut and run. And there's, in a sense, where the problems began, because it's easy to get your troops in there. It's much less easy to get your troops out.
Speaking of differences then and now, I'm struck in your book that those rapacious Brits in 1840, even in the military command, had skeptics, like Mansuart Elphinstone, who studied the Afghans seriously. He wrote, "Their vices are revenge, envy, avarice, rapacity, and obstinacy. On the other hand, they are fond of liberty, faithful to their friends, kind to their dependents, hospitable, brave, hardy, frugal, laborious, and prudent." In the crunch, this Elphinstone thought, that force could install a puppet government, but he wrote, "For maintaining him in a poor, cold, strong, and remote country among a turbulent people like the Afghans, it seems to me hopeless."
Exactly.
We didn't have many of those voices in the US military.
No, and, you know, if only people had read history. And it should have been particularly obvious to the Brits, because the Brits have lost not one, but three wars in Afghanistan. And in all three cases, they pulled out before 9/11 with their tails between their legs. And this became a sort of folklore of British politics as recently as the 1950s. One of the Tory prime ministers coming into office, Alec Douglas Hume, told his successor, "My dear boy, as long as you don't invade Afghanistan, I'm sure all will be well." But somehow, John Major failed to tell this to Tony Blair.
The aftermath of that disaster in 1842 was vicious, triggered by a British army of retribution. And of course, that's the question today. What follows this in the way of revenge?
Well, this is exactly it. Having lost an entire army, in the case of the British in 1842, they marched out on the 6th of January into the snow. And they were trying to march to first Jalalabad, then back into India. And in just 6 days, the 20,000 troops and camp followers and women and children who left Kabul, in the end, 6 days later, one man rode wounded in Jalalabad to tell the story, Mr. Brighton. Wow. In fact, a few sepoys, a few other people, including, for example, a Greek shop owner who'd hidden in a cave with a bottle of ouzo, emerged a bit later and limped back to India. But the image is more or less true, that an entire army is wiped out with only a handful of survivors. And this should have been a lesson for all time. You know, don't mess with this country. There's very little profit up there. And the fractious tribes who will fight each other will unite to expel the outsider. And yet, time and time again, imperial powers have gone in and limped out, broken, wounded, and with their credibility in tatters.
William Dalrymple wrote the celebrated history of a miserable war under the title Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan, 1839-42. Coming up, the great game again, in the back of beyond, Kipling country, without the romance of Kipling's masterpiece, Kim. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. Afghanistan in the 19th century was the playing field of what was called the Great Game for the rooftop of the world, among players like Russia, Iran, India, China, and the British Empire. It was the setting of Rudyard Kipling's masterpiece, the novel Kim, about an Irish orphan who becomes a player in his own right. On the historian Willie Dalrymple, I'm testing Kim's famous line, which he got from an intelligence operative, that when everyone is dead, the great game is finished, not before.
So what happened was that the fear that the British had that the Russians would march into Afghanistan, which of course finally happened in the 1980s after the British had left, that fear carried on. And there existed a sort of, well, what the Russians called the Tournament of Shadows, which meant this sort of spy war in the Himalayas between British and Russian operatives. And, you know, it makes wonderful history, and people have written, particularly Peter Hopkirk, wonderful books about this rivalry. But, you know, it wasn't much fun for the Afghans or the people caught between. And what you find is you had Tsarist armies marching down, taking over the cities like Bukhara, Khiva, Tashkent. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are massacred by Gatling guns. And so while we talk about the great game as if it's some sort of wonderful sort of James Bond set in 19th century Central Asia, it is something which resulted in imperial bloodshed on a massive scale. Maybe we should write about it with rather more in a rather more somber tone than perhaps many of my British predecessors have done.
Who paid the price in English politics for this disaster, this miscalculation, overreach, all that? Or did anybody?
In India, it was the Governor-General, who was George Eden, Lord Auckland. And bizarrely, it's the same family that then failed at Suez when Anthony Eden fell and resigned over Suez. He was the direct descendant of the guy who'd screwed up in Afghanistan 100 years earlier. So we find the same families reappearing, history again repeating itself.
You know, somebody said to me once that the moral of all that should have been, wherever the U.S. finds itself embroiled in a place with an English cemetery, go home. Could have been Iraq, Egypt, Palestine.
It's a very good adage. I don't know who said that, but it should be engraved in stone and put up somewhere in the Pentagon.
It's not clear that President Obama or President, then Vice President Biden, read your book. But interesting point. I'd love you to talk about it. Hamid Karzai, who was our puppet in Afghanistan, did read your book, and he summoned you to talk about it. What happened?
Correct. Obama did read it and may have learned some lessons, but the person who really took it seriously was Hamid Karzai, because he was haunted by the fact that everyone regarded him as the descendant of the puppet who had messed up in the 19th century. So when my book came out, I got an invitation to come to the Arg, the president's palace in Kabul. And we had a deal that I would interview him for a couple of hours each night after his iftar, the Ramadan feast, after the end of the fast in Ramadan. Hmm. And then he could ask me any question he wanted about the 19th century parallels. We did this for a week. It was rather like Sherazade. I had to sing for my supper, and then I was allowed to interview him. And he did actually alter his policy. And I, to be honest, wasn't aware of the degree to which he had become publicly more distanced from the Americans until WikiLeaks, when a whole load of cables emerged, leaked onto the front page of the New York Times, of Hillary Clinton saying, how can we stop Karzai reading this book? Because the more he reads it, the more hostile he becomes to America. He took as the lesson the fact that his ancestor, Shah Shuja, was seen to be the puppet of the Imperial British and therefore fell as a quisling. He thought that if he was able to take aid from the Americans, but publicly distance himself and make a whole load of public statements about how the Americans were bombing innocent villagers and were heavy-handed and were too rough with people, that he could somehow find a way to square the circle, that he could take the aid, but keep a political distance from his puppeteers. And he did this, and the Americans, of course, noticed. And Hillary Clinton became very agitated about this. He read Return of a King on a visit to Washington, read it in the plane rather than the briefing papers he was meant to read. And he emerged determined to make a clear blue water between himself and the White House, at least in public signalling. And all this emerged on WikiLeaks. So it's a rare case of somebody actually learning something from history. The irony is that he'd actually, Karzai, in retrospect, pulled the whole thing off. Karzai is an extremely charming man. He has huge politeness and politesse and is very adept at showing respect to tribal elders. If they walked in to talk to him from the other end of the country, he'll give them time and respect and listen to them. Even if they're illiterate old men, you know, they represent a large tribal grouping and they need to be heard. The irony is that his successor, who is a professional historian and anthropologist, Ghani, Ashraf Ghani, who's a man I know very well, who's very kind to me, who gave me sources for my book and used to be the head of history and the vice chancellor of Kabul University. Ghani didn't learn the lessons of history. He laid himself open to being perceived to be an American puppet. Plus, he didn't have the courtesy or the diplomatic skills to create a big tent.
When you say Hamid Karzai pulled it all off, do you mean the transition to the Taliban as the Americans leave?
What I'm talking about is that Karzai, who was twice elected president of Afghanistan, succeeded in basically cobbling together a coalition of tribes, because Afghanistan is still an incredibly tribal society, and you have to win over the chiefs and the tribes of each tribe in order to create a government. It's not like an American or a British democratic system where you have just to appeal directly to the voters. In a tribal society, you have to win over tribe by tribe, the elders, and find the language and the methods to pull in the different tribal leaders. And Karzai was very good at this game. He's an extremely charming man, and he created a big tent of all sorts of different tribes from all sorts of different backgrounds who were more or less reconciled to his rule.
But Ghani, who's ex-World Bank, ex-Columbia University, who was an intemperate academic with a temper. He famously threw an ashtray at a female journalist at his first press conference, who put his legs up, taking his shoes off, pointing them at tribal elders, which is a deep insult in Afghanistan and in India, who simply wasn't adept at charming the different tribal leaders to support his rule. One by one, he alienated each of them. So that in the end, what we've seen in the last 2-3 weeks is that no one really was prepared to die for him. And they were, you know, faced with the overwhelming force of the Taliban, chose to go over to them. It isn't that the Taliban were enormously popular. It was that Ghani had alienated enough people that they just weren't willing to stand up and fight for him. The Taliban are popular in the rural hinterland. That's also something which maybe hasn't come out of a lot of the reportage lately. We tend to think of the Taliban as this barbarous force who have just imposed themselves by physical force. Now, that's certainly true that they are very unpopular in the cities and with the educated class, and particularly with women who stand to lose their freedoms and their education and their jobs. But for a conservative rural population, the Taliban are seen to deliver simple justice. Quite obviously, they clearly have a following. There are a lot of people there who do support them. And a very clever president who's very charming can win over the country and persuade enough people that what he's offering is good enough for them. But Ashraf Ghani singularly failed in that. And along with Joe Biden, who pulled the rug from under that government in a way that broke the morale and the confidence of the Afghan forces and led to this spectacular collapse, Ghani must also take part of the blame for the collapse of his government.
Willie Dalrymple, there's another fascinating sequel in your own travels through Afghanistan. You write at the end of that book that you had met two of the tribal elders in Gundamak. This would be 10, 15 years ago. One of them came over and we chatted for a while over a pot of green tea. Last month, one of them said, some American officers called us to a hotel in Jalalabad for a meeting. One of them asked me, why do you hate us? I replied, because you blow down our doors, enter our houses, pull our women by the hair, and kick our children. We cannot accept this. We will fight back, and we will break your teeth. And when your teeth are broken, you will leave, just as the British left before you. It's just a matter of time. And what did he say to that? He turned to his friend and said, if the old men are like this, what will the younger ones be like? In truth, he said, all the Americans here know their game is over. It is just their politicians who deny this. And then the other one said, these are the last days of the Americans. Next, it will be China.
The Chinese have made deals with the Taliban. They prepared for this moment, and they have just reopened their major copper mine, which is the major resource thereafter in Afghanistan, at a place called Mezainak, which is also tragically the site of a major early Buddhist city, which looks likely now to be destroyed under the mine. And the Chinese are all set to do business with these guys. And I suspect that the real casualties of this, well, obviously, there are multiple casualties of this major setback for American foreign policy. For the first of all, no one's going to take the promises of either America or NATO seriously again for a long time. It may take 10 years, like Vietnam, for America's credibility to recover. I don't think anyone really has quite realized how serious this is. But also, obviously, other than the Afghans themselves, particularly those who helped America and NATO, the interpreters, the go-betweens, those who put their faith in America and NATO's promises, as well as all those, we're going to see this as a major setback for the West as a whole, because China is all set now to do business. Obviously, they have fears too. They are extremely worried about Uyghur separatism, which is what all these concentration camps in the west of China have been about. These terrible stories that have been coming out about the Uyghurs being locked up in work camps and huge human rights abuses among the Uyghurs. Why? Because the Chinese fear the sort of Talibanization of Muslim Western China. But nonetheless, they see this as an opportunity to enlarge their influence and to use the economic opportunities to mine Afghan copper, and the rare earths they're going to need for their computer screens and their mobile phones. So I think this is a major setback for America and a major plus for China.
Well, let me ask you, what sort of a world event will be remembered here? And will it be the last war for Afghanistan?
And certainly won't be the last war for Afghanistan, because every imperial power has always seen it as a desirable imperial asset. They think, at least looking from a distance, looking from the war games, whether it's in Beijing or in Tehran or in Tashkent or in Moscow or in London or in Washington, this looks like a very attractive imperial property. So I don't think this will be the last war, but I do think this marks the end of American influence in that region for a long time. America had encouraged a whole range of different groups in Afghanistan to trust in them, and every one of those people now is trying to flee the country. Some will manage to get out, most will not. We will see a massive displacement of refugees into Iran, out of Iran into Turkey, out of Turkey into Greece and Western Europe, just like we did with the Syrian refugees. You know, these things are now global events. They don't just get restricted to one or two countries. We will see the credibility of NATO and America hugely reduced, even more than before. America and NATO will seem as heartless, careless Western imperialists who are after their own interests and who betrayed all the people that were allied with them. And I think this is a major flip for China that we'll see, you know, their quiet way of using economic influence and putting the economic interests first, that they can mine Afghanistan without having to put a single troop in there. And maybe that is an approach that the Afghans can live with. If they can sell their copper and their rare earths, but not have an occupation, maybe that's the way that an imperial power can do business with Afghanistan. Certainly, we've shown the way not to do it. Britain showed it first in the 19th century, and now, tragically, America has shown the way not to do it in the early 21st.
Willie, I'm dying to know, what does India care about this outcome? India, which has always seen Afghanistan as sort of the worst side of Pakistan, deeply invested, it's the great giant of the neighborhood.
It's an established fact that the Taliban were not only given shelter within Pakistan, but they were given assistance, armed and trained by the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI. And therefore, India saw this as basically the Taliban is basically a Pakistani project. They therefore did all they could to bolster the government of Karzai and Ashraf Ghani. They had road building campaigns. They, for a long time, considered sending boots on the ground, but probably very wisely chose not to. And they are very worried now because they see this as a major reverse for Indian foreign policy and a major victory for their enemies in Pakistan. Likewise, the Pakistanis are extremely happy with how this goes. And every post I put on Twitter has had a whole chorus of Pakistanis saying basically sort of pro-Taliban remarks and anti-Karzai and anti-Ashraf Ghani remarks. So within that little glass bubble of Indo-Pak rivalry, this is seen as a major World Cup victory for Pakistan and a major loss for India. They may have more complicated outcomes, though, because the Taliban have their own interests. They're not just, contrary to what many Indians believe, they're not just a Pakistani game. They have their own interests. They're very happy to take assistance and shelter from Pakistan when it's offered. But now they're in power, and now that they are out of the hands of Pakistan intelligence in Quetta and back in Kabul, their interests may diverge from that of Pakistan. They may choose to, you know, do their own games. Likewise, for India, I saw one Indian analyst say this could be a major gain for the Quad, this new grouping which China is part of, Australia is part of, allied against, and Japan is part of, allied with America against China. And this may see a closer American-Indian alliance. Now, America has, you know, many problems with the Modi government, which is, in many sense, a Hindu fascist government. On the other hand, it's exactly this sort of event that may encourage the Biden administration to move forever closer ties with India and to draw a firm line in the sand against aiding Pakistan, which has received, you know, huge quantities of American military aid. in the last 20 years while still arming the Taliban. So this could be a major realignment regionally, with America drawing closer than ever to India and finally cutting off Pakistan completely.
Next time, you'll explain how the United States could be the sponsor and protector of Pakistan in so many ways, militarily and otherwise, and Pakistan could be the protector and sponsor of our worst enemy, the Taliban, now in power in Afghanistan. Does this make sense?
I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that the Pakistanis have pulled off, in a sense, that they managed to get America helping them and arming them and providing them with the extremely sophisticated American fighters that they need to take on India, while at the same time, by using very clever distancing mechanisms, creating secret cells within the ISI, which arm, aid, train and shelter the Taliban. And the real expert on this is somebody in the US, Steve Cole, whose Director at S published last year, is the last word on that. Ahmed Rashid's work is also fantastic. So anyone wanting to know more about this extraordinary double game that up to now the Pakistanis have effectively pulled off of pretending to be American allies while aiming their enemy should read Director at S.
We're great admirers of Steve Call and huge admirers of you. William Dalrymple, The Return of a King is his book that it's not too late to read. William Dalrymple, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Great pleasure to be back.
Coming up, Anthropology 101 in Afghanistan Today. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Finally, this hour, a shockingly odd take on the news from Afghanistan. Shocking because it felt so commonsensical and so unlike any of the punditry we've all been reading and hearing. Nancy Lindisfarne and Jonathan Neal are American-born anthropologists, which is to say reporters with PhDs. Most of 50 years ago, each on their own discovered South Asia and Afghanistan in particular as a field of unending interest. As partners now, living mostly in England, they blog their grounded views with an air of independence. Their headline over the weekend on the fall of Kabul to the Taliban was "Afghanistan, the End of the Occupation." A lot of nonsense, they said, is being written in the US and Britain to cover up the plain truth of what's happened. So I asked them to spell out their understanding with us. Nancy Lindisfarne and Jonathan Neal, welcome to Open Source. Begin again with your own six-point framework.
Thanks, Chris. I think the place to start is with a very hard, very difficult truth. The Taliban have defeated the United States. And it's a military victory, a victory for people who started out wearing sandals against the greatest military power in the world. And it's also a political victory because, in fact, the Taliban are now forming a new government in Kabul. And you're right. It's a shock. It's a surprise for people all around the world. But it is also a fact.
May I say, Nancy, what rang a chord for me in that was the sense that the collapse of our Afghan war was not at all a surprise, really, to most of us. And nonetheless, it's a world historical event. And a revelation that we want still bitterly not to see. Another defeat by desperately poor people in Asia.
That's true. And I think the Taliban have won because they have more popular support than anybody else over this last 20 or indeed this last 40 years. What we don't want to look at is that nobody wins a guerrilla war without popular support, without the support of people on the ground, people like us. Men, women, villagers, townspeople. And this becomes even harder to get our heads around because of the disproportionate power of the Taliban and the great professional force of the American enemy that they were fighting.
That sounds like point two, that there's a political victory here as important as what you're calling a military victory.
Yeah.
How did they do it, these monsters, in all of our perceptions?
They did it because they're not monsters, and it's not quite right that most Afghans support them. It's that most Afghans have chosen them over the American occupation. You look back in history, when the Americans first came right after 9/11, Most Afghans decided to accept the American occupation. There, for 2 years, there was no violent resistance at all in Afghanistan. They'd had 23 years of war. They wanted peace. They thought maybe the Americans will bring peace. Maybe they'll get us out of poverty. Neither of these things happened. The American military continued the war against the Afghan villagers, took people away and tortured them, and they bombed the villages and killed men and women and girls and boys, and the war went on. Some people in the country became dizzyingly rich, and the government was enormously corrupt, but poor people stayed poor. And so over 20 years, more and more Afghans decided to choose the Taliban over the occupation, almost reluctantly.
I want to linger, though, on the fact of their political victory and also an incredible level of just plain ignorance in this country about who they are and what was going on. In this country, it's almost ignorance by design. Our best media monitor finds this week that the three major television networks in the U.S. gave a grand total of, unbelievable, 5 minutes in all of 2020 to news from Afghanistan, including the so-called Doha Agreement, in which the Trump administration was planning its exit in talks with the Taliban. I mean, did we know that? Do we know almost anything about that country?
Not a whole bunch. I think that's quite important.
It's been allowed to drop out of the news simply because it was such bad news. There was no way to spin this. Trump agreed to leave, and Biden has agreed to leave because the Taliban had won. And that is such a stark piece of news. Americans haven't been told it, but we live in Britain, and there's the same kind of astonishment in Britain. Oh my God, is this what's happening? The lack of information is not just American.
And the Taliban have won this war because they've gotten smart and they've gotten local support. They've become very sophisticated in their understanding of the kind of international play that's going on. So I would focus on that first. If we want to understand the military victory, it's enormously important that we see how they have been able to change.
They have broadened their base, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. When they were in power before the American occupation, they behaved in quite racist ways towards the other ethnic groups in the country. And that made it very difficult for them to be the government. And they learned from that. And the last 20 years, they've made enormous efforts to recruit poor people, villagers from all the ethnic groups all over the country. And that's new. They have opened the prisons and released all prisoners of all sorts. They have taken the cities without killing hardly anybody. A very important moment last week was Ashura, the major religious event of the year for the Shia minority of Hazara people. This was in Kabul at the main Shia mosque. The Taliban mayor went to the mosque with Taliban troops to protect all the worshipers, to make sure there were no attacks on them. They're trying very hard because they know they need to unite the country. And they want to make peace with the outside powers. They don't want to offend people. There will be some brutality. This has been a very long civil war. There are enormous grudges, but the signs so far about the Taliban not being brutal, the signs are good. Whether that will hold or not, we don't know. I think concentrating all the time on how terrible the Taliban are, it distracts attention from the fact that the world has changed and that the United States has been defeated. It's also true that people have changed enormously in the United States. After 9/11, 90% of Americans were in favor of the invasion of Afghanistan. Last month, 2/3 of Americans were in favor of immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan. Americans have decided on the basis of long experience that this kind of war is not a good idea. And large majorities of Americans don't want any more foreign wars. I think that's a good thing for the world, but mainly I think it's a good thing for Americans too.
There's another change which should be mentioned, and that is the states around Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, the Central Asian republics, and so forth, are also not interested in seeing this war go on. They're frightened of great numbers of refugees coming into their countries. They're frightened of their own people rising up if there's more crisis in Afghanistan. So they are also working for peace, as indeed are the Chinese at this point. So I think we have to also take that kind of change into account as well.
I think the neighbors in East Asia, I think this is right, Nancy, they're praying for peace in Afghanistan. Last week, just before the fall of Kabul, the Afghan foreign minister went to Beijing. And he stood with the Chinese foreign minister, and the Chinese foreign minister said, "We want peace in Afghanistan." And the Afghan Taliban minister said, "We will cause no trouble for China." And I think that they are not distressed. But I also think that if America cannot fight foreign wars, that's good for Americans. But if China is becoming a greater power, that's not necessarily good. We're not saying China good, United States bad. We're looking at it more from the point of view of the people in the small countries. They are the footballs who get kicked back and forth.
They're where proxy wars take place.
Where proxy wars take place. And we're not hoping for a new human dawn necessarily. We're hoping that the Afghans get 10 or 20 years of peace.
Nancy and Jonathan, I'm just struck that the curtain has been pulled again on the wizards in the Pentagon, the planners of all this. Steve Walt, the Harvard realist, wrote in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, "Remaking Afghanistan in our image was a fool's errand from the start," he said. "Didn't we all know that military empires are not in the business of imposing democracy on poor, mostly illiterate, conflicted places like Afghanistan?" Steve Walt added that deadly line from General Douglas Lute, the sometimes White House coordinator of Afghan strategy, who eventually admitted, "We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." I mean, we all sort of sensed that, but it was never the headline. And I'm longing for a sort of modern version of the Pentagon Papers about how we got into Vietnam. I mean, thousands of pages of planning by very smart people, and they were utterly wrong. Will we get that? How can we get that about the non-planning in Afghanistan to this point?
That's a good question, actually. I hope there's somebody out there doing it.
I wonder if there's anything in the planning documents for the war in Afghanistan.
No.
And there's a kind of arrogance, a superpower arrogance, which I think has blinkered the political establishment and the military establishment. When you have great, great firepower, when you've spent millions and billions on armaments, you imagine you're invulnerable.
I'm burdened by thinking of maybe lazy citizens like me who have never accepted this vision of our country as a military empire, and now we simply can't look away from it. I mean, I'm troubled by how we forgot what we thought we had learned as citizens after Vietnam. 2 million Vietnamese dead, virtually no strategic objective reached, a complete misunderstanding of the Vietnamese relationship with China and all that. We thought we had incorporated some of that into our basic citizen thinking, and I don't know, it happened again. And what's been smashed in Afghanistan, not least, is our denial, our pretense of a kind of anti-imperial innocence. Though our country wouldn't do that, but it did, and it's paying a price. Your sixth point was about the rhetoric of saving Afghan women, widely used to justify the occupation of Afghanistan. Many feminists in Afghanistan, you wrote, have chosen the side of the occupation. Explain that. And how the feminists of the world and Afghanistan get out of that trap.
Both Jonathan and I are feminists, so he can take this one up. I'll come back if need be.
It's a big assignment, Jonathan. Go for it.
That's the starting point. What's happened with women's rights in Afghanistan is a tragedy. We have to look straightforwardly at the unpleasant truth that the Taliban are sexist. And what's worse, the majority of people in Afghanistan now accept that sexism, that hostility to feminism. Two reasons. One, like you said, is that the invasion, they said it was done to rescue Afghan women. And that means when people turned against the occupation in Afghanistan, they turned against feminism and feminist ideas. But there's also the history. In the 1980s, the Soviet Union invaded, and they also said they were doing it to save Afghan women. In that Soviet occupation, they killed 1 million people. They maimed 1 million people for life. They drove 6 million people into refugee camps in a country of 25 million. Oh. That's as if a foreign power had invaded America to rescue American women, and that invasion killed 12 million Americans and drove 72 million Americans into refugee camps. It, feminism has worked in the United States because people campaign from the bottom up, not by killing people.
The only thing I would add here is understanding the role of the very, very vicious stereotypes about Afghan men as well as Afghan women, which were put in play to sell the war after 9/11. So suddenly, Afghan women became enormously passive, helpless, people to be rescued, and Afghan men became vicious, ugly, cruel, primitive human beings. So what selling the war involved was creating stereotypes which played on certainly the sexism of the Taliban, which was its Achilles heel, the weakness of the Taliban. And it played into the rising sense of women's liberation and the consequences for rights of women. So you get a very acute contradiction in this process.
Nancy and Jonathan, yeah. I want your constructive advice to decent Americans who feel they've been had again, and how to get back to a kind of human level of construction and recognition here. I'm thinking not least of those refugees, the Afghans.
Absolutely. The first step is to work very hard to demonstrate, to protest so that the borders are open and there is asylum, refuge for people that want to get out of Afghanistan, who for whatever reasons fear for themselves or their families, or who have been compromised by having to support their families, work for the regime, work for the occupation. So finding the power to insist on asylum for these people, I think, is enormously important, not just in the United States, but also in Britain and in all the countries who contributed to this military onslaught.
Simple humanity. And I think there is a great groundswell of feeling in Europe and the United States. Let these people in. Give them a home. Give them a refuge.
I've got to ask, where do you feel the groundswell? We've seen it elsewhere, but not particularly, say, with Syrians in this country. Where do you see the project building?
You're absolutely right that there was tremendous racism against Syrians refugees. There's been tremendous racism against Afghan refugees and people from Africa and people from Mexico and Central America. There's been almost a war on immigrants for a long time in the United States, but much worse in Europe. I think in this particular case, the moral case for rescuing these people from Afghanistan, the moral case is enormously strong. And whether it's going to push through all the way, I don't know. I wait to see. But we started with the question, what can decent Americans do? I mean, decent people of all views. The decent thing is to try and open up your city to take some of these people.
To imagine that they're, but for the grace of God, go we. To actually turn to the empathic goodwill of our ordinary people here and ask us just to put ourselves in the shoes of those people and to care for them.
These are people who need help, and these are people to whom promises were made.
The moral cue is clear. The political cue is still a question. I noted in President Biden speaking of getting some of those Afghan refugees out of the trap, people who had worked with us now could be targeted by the Taliban. He says, we'll do our best. But he's also saying in the same breath, don't worry, people, those planes are not coming directly to the United States. We'll see.
We'll see. And that's true, what you say, and that is shameful.
And then we'll see about writing the course of our country in the world. Nancy Lindisfarne and Jonathan Neal, thank you for lifetimes of serious attention to Afghanistan. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having us, Chris.
Thanks.
Nancy Lindisfarne is co-author with Richard Tapper of Afghan Village Voices, Stories from a Tribal Community, republished last year. Jonathan Neal has written a shelf full of books, fiction and fact, including Tigers of the Snow, about mountain climbers in the Himalayas. Together, Jonathan and Nancy write at the blog site they named for a pirate lady It's Anne with an E, BonniePirate.org. That's where you'll find their new entry on Afghanistan, the end of the occupation. Big thanks again to the master historian, William Dalrymple, who wrote Return of a King. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is our peacekeeper. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of independent podcasts making some of the smartest audio out there. This week, check out Iconography. It's a show about icons, real and mythic, as in host Charles Gustin's visit to the site of the now fallen Old Man of the Mountain, the granite face that gave New Hampshire its emblem and then fell apart. Listen in at iconographypodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts, and learn more about the whole lineup of Hub and Spoke at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.